If you haven't been with us, I'm going to recap just really briefly what we did 2 weeks ago. So we didn't meet last week because it was Memorial Day weekend. So let me just try to quickly recap what we were doing the week before, and then we're going to jump into what is the main focus of our topic here today, which has to do with Bible transmission. So 2 weeks ago, we made a shift from doctrine to apologetics. And we noted that there's a place for apologetics. Apologetics isn't all that there is in the Christian life and faith, and it can only take you so far, ultimately. But there is a place for apologetics. And so we noted that there was a chain of five big questions. And you can see those five big questions that are, again, printed for you in today's handouts. Can we be confident that the translation of the Bible from its original language accurately reflects the original? Can we be confident that the copyist accurately transmitted the original writing to us? Can we be confident that we're looking at the right set of books and that we haven't missed or lost the set of books out there that gives us a different but equally reliable and plausible perspective on Jesus? Can we be confident that the original authors were themselves trustworthy? Can we be confident the authors did, in fact, intend to give an accurate account of what happened and that what they described really took place? In other words, is it true? So you see those questions. They're working from the present day all the way back into the first century. And thinking through, if we can answer these questions, maybe not with certainty, there's only so much historical certainty you can have about anything, but if we can answer these questions and we can think through that, do we have good intellectual reasons for believing that these things can be answered positively, then we have a good basis for understanding that the Christian faith is to be believed. So we looked at the translation question last week, and we answered that question saying yes. Yes, the Bible has been accurately translated over and over again. So we can have confidence that that is the case. So what we wanted to switch to today is question number two. Lord willing, we'll look at question number three next week. And then the other two, we won't deal with quite as much in these particular set of classes. So the question that we want to think through here is, can we be confident that the copyist accurately transmitted the original writing to us, right? So it's great, we can translate. If we can translate well, that's really good. But if we're not actually translating the right thing, then it doesn't matter. And so this is a very important question. I think it's a question a lot of people have questions about. And one of the things that we did look at last time was that Newsweek article, and just a quote from it, in which the author said, "No television preacher has ever read the Bible, neither has any evangelical politician, neither has the Pope, neither have I, and neither have you. At best, we've all read a bad translation, a translation of translations of translations, of hand-copied copies of copies of copies of copies, and on, hundreds of times." So we noted that it's a bit of a misleading kind of quote. So we're going to work through this. Are we simply dealing with bad translations and copies of copies of copies, and in essence, you can't really trust the Bible? Well, the answer will be, I hope you can see, that we can indeed have confidence, but we need to work through this. So a couple key factors to keep in mind as we do that. Keep in mind the number of distinct pieces, the number of manuscripts that we have connected to the Bible. So when we're talking about Greek manuscripts, we're talking over 5,000, about 5,700 distinct pieces from the ancient world when it comes to the Greek New Testament that we have access to. Some of these manuscripts contain whole books. Others have been partially destroyed, so that only portions of the books remain. Others are just mere fragments. None of them are the originals. We know this last time that they are all copies of something older, so we don't possess the original manuscripts of the Bible. These different manuscripts that we have, they've been found scattered all over what used to be the Roman Empire, hidden in caves, buried in ancient ruins, some even found in what would have been the trash dumpster. So found all over the ancient Roman Empire. They come from the first three or four centuries of Christian history. And then that's just the Greek New Testament. If you include other languages within that and quotations from the church fathers as well, you have more than 24,000 manuscripts and pieces of manuscripts. So 24,000 manuscripts and pieces of manuscripts when we come to look at the scriptures from the ancient world. So that's one key factor to keep in mind. We'll come back to it. The other one is that to recognize that there are indeed variations between some of these manuscripts. But as we'll see, that's actually a positive thing and a helpful thing. And so we'll get to that. So let's think a little bit about these New Testament manuscripts. So the earliest copies were all written in the mid to late first century. So the originals all written. The earliest copies we have of various portions are from about maybe as early as 125, 150, 200, so 2nd century. So that's actually a relatively small gap between the original and the first copy that we have. Okay, we get around to a relatively small gap between the original and the first copy that we have. I think another thing to keep in mind is that people took care of their books. I don't know how you take care of your books today. Books mean a lot to me. I try to take care of them. I have kids who come around and like to pull them off the shelves. But other than that, I like to keep care of them. Keep them alphabetized. Keep them well ordered. Try to keep them out of the sun. I have easy access to books like you do. The thing about the ancient world, we don't quite have easy access to books. There's no quick order on Amazon to replace a book. They took care of their books. They last for decades and decades and decades. And studies of ancient libraries actually show this. It's very interesting. There's a whole kind of study out there that shows these ancient libraries and how people preserve books and how long that they lasted. So therefore, it's more than a little likely that the originals penned by the authors themselves would have been preserved and used to make countless new copies over decades or even centuries before they were lost. So it's not that there's just kind of one copy, and then that one copy is used for another copy, which is used for another copy, which is then used for another copy. Quoting Craig Blomberg, who I mentioned to you last time, he says, the original copy of a biblical book would most likely have been used to make countless new copies over a period of several centuries, leading to still more favorable conditions for careful preservation of its contents. And so to say that all we have is copies of copies of copies is a little overstated. Second and third century New Testament manuscripts may well be copies of the very original autographs, or at least copies of those copies. The other thing that we need to make sure that we're keeping in mind is the historical reality of other ancient documents. So you have this other handout in front of you again this week. I referenced it just briefly last week, but if you take a look at it, so Derek Thomas, in his book on the Bible, has put this together, which is kind of common. I'm sure you've seen something like this before, probably. So if you look at some of the other ancient works, right? We got Homer and Caesar, Plato, Aristotle, and you can see when they've been written, and you can see the earliest copy that we have of that ancient document, and you can see the time span between when it was written and the earliest copy. You also see on that far right-hand column the number of copies or the partial copies. So again, if you just look at the very bottom where the New Testament is, if you compare it to all these other well-known, trusted, ancient works, it's actually overwhelming in terms of the manuscript evidence, in terms of when it was written to the earliest copy we have, the time span in between there, and the actual number of copies or partial of copies that exist. So again, the copies we have go back very far. They're based on an unparalleled number of manuscripts compared to the rest of the ancient world. Let me stop there. Questions, comments, concerns, thoughts?
I'm not positive about this, but I think, if I'm recalling correctly from my college career, that those like Caesar, Plato, Herodotus, a lot of the ancient authors we would not have but for Arabic translators. So these have been translated from Greek into Arabic and then back into Greek and then discovered in the Middle Ages. So you've got that problem too. This is going through like three different translations for the classical authors.
Yeah. I mean, historically you can see how that would happen. Then that may be the case. I don't know.
Yeah. I had a course in Muslim studies. I'm pretty sure that's accurate, but you may want to check me before you call me.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, Kat.
As someone who loves history, I love this argument. I've used this argument, but it occurs to me that because I normally say to someone, "Well, you trust that Caesar was a real person, and there's far less evidence about that than there is about Jesus being a real person and what he said and did." But our trust that Caesar was a real person is very different to the trust that we are asking someone to have in the scriptures and in Jesus.
Yeah.
It's a different level of life trust.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I'm just, I don't know, it's sort of an open question, not a specific question, but just a problem that I'm seeing that This might be making one point, but it doesn't fix the problem.
No, one says no, right? I mean, you're not going to, and this isn't meant to fix the problem, as it were, in terms of this will not never convince a skeptic to go, oh yeah, well, geez, Jesus really did die for my sins, and he rose from the dead, and I should now live under his submission and lordship. No, it's not meant to do that. It's not going to do that. You're right, but and I think it's a helpful point. I think maybe we talked about this a lot a couple weeks ago, where, you know, we don't, you know, nobody ever raises concerns about are we actually reading the great works of Plato, but at the same time, we're not asking people to, as you said, put the same level of trust in Plato as they would put in Jesus and the scriptures. So in one sense, it's fair to say, well, you know, it is different. It's a different. At the same time, it's still a point. I mean, it's one of those pegs within it. And, you know, just I think, again, I don't think we ever, you know, historical certainty is different than mathematical certainty. And so none of these things, this is where apologetics only has a place, where it's not the ultimate. It can only go so far. Because it's never going to convince anybody ultimately. But what apologists can do is to say, you know, look, it is, it's not just a blind leap of faith, right? There are good intellectual reasons for believing that the scriptures are trustworthy, and so I think that's where kind of the apologetics and the manuscript stuff fits in there. Angela.
So I'm noticing like how short of a time there is between the New Testament, like original manuscript, and the copies that partial manuscripts that we have now.
Yeah.
Is that just because of maybe like the type of paper that was used? Like the original paper was not of the quality that it lasted the ages, so like the better preserved stuff lasted?
I'm not sure. I don't. Not that I know of. It could be. I think it testifies more to the importance of the manuscripts in terms of what they meant to the early Christian communities. Yeah, that they were people of the book, and the book mattered, and so they copied and copied and passed it on into language and language and language, yeah. Yeah.
Whereas Plato would only have been read by intellectuals.
Yeah, right, not the same sort of, in the same way it doesn't have the same demand, it doesn't have the same sort of life transformation and hope and spread in the same way.
Also, like with Homer, I mean, the way that I learned it is there's probably many. There was no one Homer, there's probably several. It was an oral tradition. If you look at the language in the Iliad, there's all sorts of repetition, different phrases used, different ways. He always talks about like the wine dark sea. Never talks about the sea. It's always the wine dark sea. And that's in part so that people could remember it. Because I think a lot of the Greek mythology was based on orally. So they had lots of repetition to do that.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely, yeah, very oral. A very oral culture, yeah.
Maybe I missed this, but is that from the Old Testament?
Well, we're looking at the New Testament right now. It's easier to look at the New Testament than the Old Testament. Old Testament's a little more challenging in terms of just... Well, once it's simpler, it's more simple because it's just there. It's kind of usually the strategy that, listen, if there's good evidence for the New Testament itself affirms the Old Testament, and so I think it's, you know, more clearly, can you establish the New Testament first? Yeah.
It's the book is always been between Old Testament and New Testament, like what we have now, or they last time it's separate?
No, yeah, separate. I mean, there's definitely a separation. So, you know, I think many scholars would say that by the first century, the Old Testament canon, as it were, is set and established, and certainly you can see in the Church Fathers that they're distinguishing in a good way. They're distinguishing between, you know, an old covenant and a new covenant, and the writings for the old covenant and the writings for the new covenant. Yeah. All right. Well, let's look at another serious charge here. So another serious charge is that there are so many variants between all the copies that they just can't be trusted. So this is where I think Peter mentioned Bart Ehrman a few weeks ago. You may know the name Bart Ehrman. He's become sort of kind of popular. One of his books called Misquoting Jesus, he writes this. He says, excuse me, scholars differ significantly in their estimates. Some say there are 200,000 variants known. Some say 300,000. Some say 400,000 or more, ! We do not know for sure because despite impressive developments in computer technology, no one has yet been able to count them all. Perhaps, as I indicated earlier, it is best simply to leave the matter in comparative terms. There are more variations among our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament.
Wow.
If you don't know much about the Bible, you read that and you go, wow, there's no way I can trust the Bible. There's just so many variations. How could you ever possibly trust it? So how do we respond to something like that in a book called Misquoting Jesus, which kind of gives away the argument? Well, so first, I think one thing is to make sure that your method of counting is correct. So all these variations, maybe there's 400,000, maybe it's more like 200,000, but let's say there's 400,000. Well, they're all spread across these thousands of manuscripts. So some of the variations as well, they're easily identifiable as being a clear mistake from a copyist. You know very clearly that the copyist made a mistake there. Something else to keep in mind, some are singular, so they show up in one and only one manuscript. It said that maybe 45% of the variations fit that category. And so in the end, we might be talking more along the lines of something around 200, 250,000 variations, which may still sound like a lot, but again, you got to remember that they're spread out over, if we just take the Greek manuscripts, they're spread out over 5,700 Greek manuscripts, and thus they're spread out over millions of words. In fact, if you take the 24,000 plus manuscripts, it only averages out to 16 variants per manuscript. Only 8 per manuscript if the real number of variants is only around 200,000. Let me give you an example of what that means. So Greg Gilbert, he refers to John chapter 18 and just kind of uses that as an example. Kind of think through make sure your counting is correct. And so let me just read this example that he provides. He says, in the Greek language, John 18 is 791 words. And the manuscripts we have of that chapter include 3,058 variations. Is it fair then to say that there are 3.9 variations per word in John 18? Of course not. Those 3,058 variations are spread over 1,659 manuscripts of John 18. If we can assume that those 1,659 manuscripts have an average of 791 words each, then those 3,058 variations are spread over some 1,312,296 words that the copyist actually wrote. Even more when you consider that 1,767 of those 3,058 are singular variations, and another 187 are obviously nonsensical, you wind up with 1,104 significant variants over 1,312,296 words, or just one for every 1,188 words. I don't follow all the numbers in that, but in the end, it's not quite what Bart Ehrman is saying. It's a little misleading when he just kind of throws the number out there. He doesn't provide sort of any explanation. So again, the idea that there are 400,000 variants isn't quite accurate. Okay, second thing to keep in mind is that comparing the variations is actually very revealing. The fact that there are so many manuscripts allows scholars to compare them. And when you do that over so many, it's not hard to come to a determination of where the copyist's error occurred. In fact, by comparing the surviving ancient copies and thinking carefully about why copyists might have made certain changes or errors, scholars can reach highly confident conclusions about what the original documents actually said. So let's explore this a little bit further. We're going to do a little bit of an exercise here. This comes from Greg Gilbert as well. So he compares using variants to figure out what the original said, to kind of being like solving a logic puzzle. Because when variants appear in the copies, scholars are usually identify not only that a scribe introduced a variant to his copy, but they can also think through why the scribe did so. So some of these reasons identified by scholars for why variants sometimes make their ways into the copies, well, sometimes it's just purely accidental. Letters that look similar might be switched out for each other. I do that all the time when I'm writing. I don't know if you guys do that. You're just gonna swap a letter. You don't mean to do it. Words might be skipped accidentally. I mean, that's sometimes when I'm writing out a quote. I'm like looking at something, and you're going back and forth, and you just kind of leave something out. Words might be doubled. Even whole sections might be skipped when the same word was used a few lines apart. So sometimes it's just purely accidental. At other times, there are variants because the changes were introduced in a deliberate way. So a scribe might decide that a word or a name was misspelled and try to correct it. Or he might change something in one passage that it would agree with another passage. Or he might even fix a word or two to clear up problems he perceived. Usually not good for the scribe to do that. Or the scribe might add something to the text in order to clarify what he thinks the readers should take from it, and just essentially make it sort of a commentary. So again, let's look at this, let's do this exercise. It's there in your handouts. Here's an example of how scholars might reason through variants to arrive at a confident conclusion of what the originals said. So we'll take fragment A, we'll call it. And here's how this reads. Now we are engaged in a great civil war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. Fragment B. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives so that the nation of which we speak might live. All right, so what are the variants between these two imaginary fragments? What's that?
More details.
More details. B? Yeah, more details in B. B is obviously longer. Yeah. Other variations.
It's more than just details, because actually the meaning in B, which I think is the one that was probably really said, is greater because it deals with whether or not the nation itself can survive.
Sure,
so
you leave out a chunk.
Goes the meaning.
In you leave out a chunk, you lose part of the meaning. Yeah, for sure. So,
except
that
B, the matching sentence, the matching final sentence in the first one says that the nation might live, and then in the second one that the nation of which we speak might live would. I mean, this is a total guess, but I would guess that that means that they have added all that nation speak in. And then in the final sentence, they're like, oh, no, we need to say that nation, of, you know, we need to refer back to the nation. We've inserted all this nation talk.
Right, well, right.
A does the same thing, because it gave their lives that nation might live. So that replaces the of which we speak. So
that's
one
true.
Says of which we speak, the other just says that.
Although the second one does say that nation of which we speak.
Right.
All right.
So
that
nation.
Oh, loves that nation.
That's a
struggle yes.
there, because in the original Gettysburg Address, it does end the way
Fragment A does.
Cheating. Cheating. All right, so we're just playing around here. We're trying to get a sense of how scholars might go about their work as they look at different fragments. So you've identified the two variations. Okay, one B is longer than A, very clearly, and also the last sentence is different. Okay, slightly different, but it's definitely different. So why is that the case? And when we take these two fragments, what might that tell us about the original? So again, we're kind of thinking of how might scholars go about their work as they're looking at all the different fragments of the biblical text. So the section that's omitted in A, right? Scholars might look at that and think, well, it'd be hard to come up with a good reason why a copyist would add those words if they weren't originally there, right? So the question then is, well, why would a copyist potentially omit them? Well, I think, just kind of thinking through reasons why sometimes things get left out as you're copying something. Note how the word war shows up twice in fragment B. Now we are engaged in a great civil war. And you skip down, we are met on a great battlefield of that war. So the word war kind of brackets the omitted fragment, right? In other words, it becomes a place where copyists, they lose their sight of focus. They see the word war, they look down, they look back over, and then kind of they see the second war and they carry on without realizing that they've skipped a section. So as far as scholars would fairly confidently say that the longer reading in B is probably correct. Okay, but what about the second variation dealing with the ending? Well, scholars would likely conclude that there's no good reason to amend an original set that said that the nation of which we speak might live, changing it to that nation might live. Right? It would just make it kind of awkward. That phrasing of it in fragment A is a little bit awkward. Therefore, it's more likely that a copyist would correct the that phrasing to something maybe a little bit less grating on the ear. And for that reason, we should probably conclude that the harder reading is that which reflects the original. It's usually a way that scholars will approach it. The harder reading is that which reflects the original. So given all that, we could reconstruct the original like this. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. Anyway, so I hope that maybe gives us a little bit of a sense of kind of what the process might be like. Just kind of by reasoning through why copyists might make certain changes, we're able to arrive at a confident conclusion about what the original document actually said. And that's what scholars have been doing for centuries with the fragments and manuscripts of the New Testament that are available to us. I think it's important to understand this isn't a matter of guesswork. It's not magic. It's not just kind of assumption or simply making things up. It's a matter of careful, deductive reasoning.
This is kind of like forensic accounting.
Yeah.
Forensic accounting. I don't know what forensic accounting is, but
See a number in the books and you think that doesn't mesh, and you go backwards.
You kind of work
sources
it through
and
yeah.
You
so there you go.
Find
yeah.
What, where's the error come in?
Yeah.
Or where's the misleading, potentially misleading
yeah.
thing?
Here's a simple example from the New Testament. So some existing manuscripts differ as to whether Matthew chapter 5, verse 22 originally read Jesus saying, "But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment," or, "But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother without cause will be liable to judgment." Okay, so here we have a clear variation in the ancient manuscripts. But scholars would also say we have a clear solution. Right, what scribe would really delete the words "without cause" when those words make Jesus' teaching so much more palatable? Right, not likely. Right, maybe a scribe thought he was helping Jesus out by clarifying Jesus' teaching with the phrase "without cause." So it's precisely because it's the harder reading that the first option is more likely reflecting the original. For that reason, almost all the major translations, if you look at your Bible, they'll leave out the phrase "without cause." They won't put that in there, but they will give you a footnote at the bottom of the page. You say some manuscripts have "without cause." So you can find it there in your footnotes. There's lots of other examples that we could look at. We don't have time to look at them all today. Blomberg, in his book, kind of very helpfully kind of lays them all out. I mean, there's really not that many of them. I mean, the interesting ones. There's really not that many interesting ones. Most of them are just kind of nondescript. But anyway, if you're interested, Blomberg's book, "Can We Still Believe the Bible?" is helpful on that. Now, that said, there are, however, two places in the Bible that are more substantial. So just really quick, let's look at John chapter 8 and Mark chapter 16. So John chapter 8. So if you look really what is the end of chapter 7, verse 53, and the beginning of chapter 8, verse 1, all the way through verse 11. Now, I haven't looked at these Bibles to see if this is the case. Are there brackets around those verses? Okay.
Yes.
So, mine says something like, this is a footnote that's put in by the editors, right? The earliest manuscripts do not include 753 to 811.
I don't have the actual verses, I just have the...
Well, they didn't even include it in yours.
No.
Did they put a footnote down at the bottom?
The earliest manuscript do not include it.
Right? Yeah.
So I'm missing a chunk, and the next verse that starts for chapter 8 is 53.
Yeah.
Oh, no, but that's the section. This is 753.
No, it's 853.
That's 753, but they put it in the
paragraph. Yeah,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
They went each to his own house.
It just went
753. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then it's missing. Okay.
Yeah. So look, there's two substantial places in the New Testament. This is John chapter 8 and then Mark chapter 16. But again, your Bibles tell you about it. So they're saying, look, the earliest manuscripts, the textual evidence for these two sections of Scripture is not very good. And most scholars are likely going to say, you know, these probably aren't the originals. And so this is hard because the one in John, this really meant a lot to people. And we'll think about this a little bit next week when we think about the canon and how the canon is formed. But it's probably not. I remember when I preached on this a number of years ago, I think one of the things that we did, I came at it a little bit kind of thinking through Bible canon, trying to make sure that we understand what's being told us, because nothing in John chapter 8 here is contrary to any other doctrine in Scripture. It's not like it's teaching something that nothing else is taught anywhere else. But it's probably not part of the original manuscripts. And the same is true for Mark chapter 16, beginning at verse 9. And if you were to look there as well, you would see that the same note is given you, that some of the earliest manuscripts don't include chapter 16, verses 9 through 20. So those are the two main places. And again, your Bibles will tell you that is the case.
Mark. Is it possible that the apostles themselves added them later? Or
no, look, if they believe the apostles added them later, then they would probably be included. I think, I don't know how they came about. I mean, I'm not sure anybody knows definitively.
They don't know where it came from.
That's what I'm saying. So the earliest manuscripts don't contain them. So they show up in later manuscripts. So, you know, I don't know this theory. I'm not sure. I mean, the Mark one is, I think people probably looked at Scribe, looked at the Mark one and said, oh man, wait a minute. Mark didn't tell us all about the resurrection. And feel that we got to add something in there. Mm-hmm. And they did, perhaps.
Well, it doesn't have much about his birth either.
Well,
Luke has this whole long chapter.
Yeah, so maybe a scribe's trying to help out and just kind of complete the story. Maybe not trying to be nefarious and, you know, not trying to do anything wrong, just trying to say, let me complete the argument. Let me kind of fill this in here because this is what we believe and the other gospels present it. I don't know.
Because both those passages are in other gospels.
No.
Both the incidents reported in these two passages are found in other gospels. Am I correct?
Not the one with John.
John.
Not the woman caught in adultery. It's not another one. And then there's some weird ones at the end of Mark. You know, you got the snake.
They pick up serpents with their hands, and if they drink deadly poison, it will not hurt them.
Yeah. Maybe the scribe there was trying to build off of, you know, Acts, Paul, and, you know, when he's on the island there. And he's protected by the snakes. Yeah, protected from the venom he's bitten. So the earliest manuscripts don't have those. But these are the only two places in the Bible, again, where there's anything substantial. Most are very nondescript. I mean, you know, the interesting one I gave you is the one about Jesus, you know, don't be angry without cause, or, you know, you can see where the scribe is there. I think another one is where, one of the lepers comes up to Jesus and, you know, asks to be cleansed. And it says some manuscripts say Jesus looked upon him with anger, and some manuscripts say Jesus looked upon him with compassion.
Yeah,
it's a little bit different. And those are the big things, right? I mean, again, that's not changing anything, right, in terms of the Bible. So anyway, most of these things are just kind of nondescript, you know, an extra A, as it were, kind of thrown in, and I'm going to go through and clean it up.
So
again,
Mark is where in Mark?
Verses 9 through 20, I think it is.
The end, 16.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So you get the first part of, you get the first few verses of chapter 16, but then the end is probably not there. And again, I think the scribes are just because Mark leaves it so abruptly, but I think he has good reasons within his overall project.
So
trying
why
to
don't
do.
They delete that and turn it into a footnote?
Well, they do. I mean, in a sense, that's what they've done. I mean, by bracketing that way and saying the earliest manuscripts don't include this.
But the way that you therefore read it, like the fact that you preached on John 8 and you preached on that passage, whereas if it was a footnote, that whole thing was a footnote, you wouldn't have preached on that in the same way.
Yeah, maybe.
And so having it in the text gives it an authority.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
Perceived authority.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. You may be right.
Translation.
It's a well-known story, so I probably would have done it anyway, just to. Because if I had just skipped it, I would have done like what, you know, what just happened here. I'm not sure. So again, I think it is important to emphasize that no major Christian doctrine is impacted by any of these. So I do think it's telling that Bart Ehrman, in the appendix to the paperback edition of Misquoting Jesus, himself concedes that, quote, essential Christian beliefs are not affected by textual variants in the manuscript tradition of the New Testament. Might have been helpful if we put that in the front part of the book instead of the very back where nobody's actually going to look at it properly.
Wouldn't make for as exciting reading.
Yeah. All right, so to summarize, the variants are spread across, if we take all of the different languages, 24,000 plus manuscripts. They do cluster around the same verses or passages, you know, so it's not like they're just kind of everywhere, but they're really concentrated on verses and passages. Most very boring, nondescript. None impact any significant Christian doctrine, and again, your Bibles have footnotes that are alerting you to any of those issues that are out there. So nobody's trying to deceive you. Nobody's trying to pull the wool over your eyes. Now, that is all the New Testament, as I noted. So, what about the Old Testament? Just a few words, I suppose. Without going in detail, just a couple summary points. Let me see what I have in your handout for you. So I've given you the three references to the main sources for Old Testament translations. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, and then the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947. Before that, English translations were based almost exclusively on the Masoretic text, which is named after the Masoretes, who were Jewish scribes who very carefully copied the Hebrew Bible, especially during the 6th and the 11th centuries AD. They were the ones who added the Hebrew vowel points to the continental text that they inherited. We have more than 3,000 manuscripts from the Masoretes that have survived from the 1100s through 1440. The oldest existing copy of the Masoretic text can be dated to the 9th century AD. There's a very well complete and well preserved Hebrew Old Testament codex from the Masoretes, which dates to 1008. Though these Hebrew Masoretes were they were copying more than 1,000 years, obviously, after the eras in which the Old Testament docs were first written. Scholars have long had access to the ancient manuscripts of the Septuagint, again, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And then furthermore, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls allowed scholars to really narrow in and confirm accurate translations between what they knew of the Septuagint and the Masoretic text. So sometimes there would be differences between those, and scholars weren't always exactly sure how to go about understanding which was which. But the Dead Sea Scrolls really helped with this. And so, let me just read from Bloomberg here. It's kind of a summary point on this. He says, with the discovery after World War II of portions of every Old Testament book except Esther in the caves near the shores of the Dead Sea, possibly representing the library of a separatist Jewish sect known as the Essenes at a monastic-like site called Qumran, scholars no longer need to speculate about which is the accurate translation. Overall, the most striking result of comparing these approximately 200 biblical manuscripts ranging from roughly 250 BC to AD 50 was how similar they were to the Masoretic texts of a millennium or more later. The most stunning example of this was the discovery of an entire scroll of Isaiah with only a handful of extremely minor differences in content from the Masoretic text copies dating a millennium and a quarter later. And so the point is that the copyists, they treated these things with extremely great care. And that should give us confidence that we indeed have accurate copies of the Old Testament. Final comments, questions?
The Dead Sea Scrolls had everything but Esther?
Everything but Esther, yeah.
Is that what the Jewish people need as their Bible? Is that the same? Do they take it from the same source as well?
From the which one?
The Torah or the Tanakh, like what they read as their holy book, is it from the same source? We know it's the same material, but do they have like slightly different sources? Or the?
You mean today?
Yes.
I don't know which were they all drawn from. Mark, do you want to chime in on that?
Yeah,
yes.
The answer
is yes. To all of the above, right? They put all of them together, right? Come
yeah.
up with the best.
I mean, the order is different. The order of the books is different. I grew up with the Masoretic texts, obviously, and Chronicles is at the very end, which is good because it's all just begatting.
His will say, drawn from the Masoretic text.
But yeah, but oral, what you would say, the Old Testament versus New Testament, I mean, the Old Testament is there. You don't have the apocryphal books, those are all part of the Catholic Church. That's got nothing to do with Judaism.
Yeah.
It's there. The order is different. I mean, the first five books are there. It's basically it's the law, the history, and the prophets.
Okay. That's good. Yeah, we'll try to think a little bit next week about maybe some of the difference of ordering the books, because actually it's quite revealing the different order. Yeah.
So application question: Angela and I were actually having this discussion a couple of weeks ago about do you read Mark with a non-Christian? When there's text note saying a significant portion of this is disputed, do you read that with a non-Christian?
Well, obviously I do. I don't see any problem with it. I mean, it's people have questions about the Bible, and maybe it's an opportunity to talk about it. I mean, I think more and more. I mean, people like Bart Ehrman have made such an inroad into the popular culture. I think there's just a general distrust of the Bible. I think that everybody just kind of assumes it's just a bunch of copies and copies and copies. Yeah. You can't really trust anything. And just kind of give it, you know, our own kind of postmodern mindset anyway, that there's no real clear objective knowledge. So, yeah, I think, you know, you can maybe open up good avenues of discussion. Yeah, you know, we recognize, you know, we affirm that our scriptures are different from some other religions, that, you know, God worked through a historical process, and which means that the process wasn't always perfectly clean. You know, it actually happened over centuries. We'll think more about this next week with the canon, but so yeah, maybe could open up potentially good avenues of discussion. They're not blindsided by something. But you're right, it may come out if they're not asking the questions, I suppose, it can come out of left field and just feel like, oh, I can't really trust this, can I?
I'm just not sure we want to add, maybe I will. I'm not sure I want to add doubts to
Yeah,
someone.
Well, no, I know what you mean, yeah. So maybe it depends on the person, then, I suppose.
When did the earliest Septuagint manuscripts date?
That's a good question. What do we have? Going back into well before AD. Right before the first century, I'm trying to think when the Septuagint was first translated. Somebody can Google this real quick and look it up. But right, there's a whole sort of kind of myth around sort of the translation of it. But yeah, certainly before the first century. I mean, you know, because
AD.
Yeah. So you're working on. I mean, part of what you're going to find quoted in the New Testament portions of the Greek the Septuagint.
132
BC. All right, I gotta run. Here's what I'm gonna do. So I'll give you two quotes. I'll give you the Blomberg one last one. If you didn't get a chance to reflect on that, you can reflect on that. And I'll give you another one there, Greg Gilbert. So let me just read this, and then you can kind of discuss some of the thoughts and implications about it around your table. So Gilbert writes, "The charge that we cannot know what the original said is patently and utterly false. The gap between the originals and our earliest extant copies of them is, in the grand scheme of things, not that long at all. And far from diminishing our ability to identify what the original said, the vast number of existing copies actually allows us to reason out deductively to a very high degree of historical confidence what the biblical writers actually wrote." So I'll leave you with that, and then, Lord willing, next week we'll think about why these 66 books and not those.